This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio. Tonight at 7 o'clock from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to the show. Tonight we are joined by our regular panelist, Professor Samuel Mann, and our guest tonight is Alec Dawson, who is a member of Generation Zero, a group that campaigns for a zero carbon economy. And you may remember we've met Louis Chambers and Bridget O'Leary last year, just when Generation Zero was starting up, and they've done a lot this year, so we'll be talking about them to Alec later. And the show is hosted by me, Shane Gallagher. Welcome to the show. Now, my number of the week is 21. And that's 21 opportunities for green growth identified in a new report released today in New Zealand by a group called Pure Advantage. Now, I'm going to talk about the report next week, as I haven't had a chance to read it in detail, and it is a quite a detailed report. And it has a foreword by Nicholas Stern of the famous Stern Report from Britain, and he was talking about the cost of climate change. And I really want to spend some time talking to it. I probably myself and Sam will probably have a bit of a conversation about it. Now, but it brought up in Parliament, it was brought up in Parliament today by both the Green and the Labour Party, about the lack of planning by the government with regard to moving to a green economy. And one of the points that was made implicitly, and it was something that I was thinking about recently about, green economics, was an issue that Karl Marx first identified as an issue in capitalism and economics, and that's a thing called coordination, or rather coordination failure. So coordination is defined as the unification, integration, synchronization of the efforts of group members so as to provide unity of action in the pursuit of common goals. So in an economy, that means, for instance, everyone works together to get goods from a producer to the consumer efficiently and effectively. So Marx identified the failure of coordination in markets as the cause of recessions and crises of capitalism. And we've seen that in the 2008, and we see it, ongoing crisis of capitalism because we have this lack of coordination between different sectors of the economy. And so this is why he advocated and control economies in order to avoid these coordination issues. And his vision was that the state would organize on all levels all levels of the economy, sort of coordination failures would be prevented, but these wouldn't have these crises of capital. And so one of the criticisms levelled by the right wing is that if the green economy is so good, and these ideas are so clever that the Pure Advantage people come up with, is why are they not being taken up by the private sector? And the problem is one of coordination. And it can only come from a government controlling the economy and interfering in the market, and something that's anathema to the neoliberal way of thinking, and that's why they refuse point blank to do it. So, to give an example, I think it's always easiest to look at a solid example. So if you look at a big area of growth identified by the report, and that was second generation biofuels. And these are fuels produced by woody waste or farm waste. Now, in order to build a plant that is big enough to be financially viable for the second generation biofuels, you need to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, it's a huge investment. And you also need a couple of things. You need to have a guaranteed supply of wood and waste and a guaranteed market for the biofuel that you're producing. Now, if you're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on that kind of infrastructure, you need to know that there are going to be trees to supply your fuel source. And the people who are going to plant the trees need to know that there is going to be plants that are going to use the wood that are going to produce biofuel. And they also both then need to know that the market will be there for their biofuels, so people will be able to buy them. So they have to know that for instance, the oil companies or the fuel stations are going to put the biofuels make them available, and so they can have a market so they can sell them. Because these are huge, massive investments that are going to take decades to repay themselves. So these involve huge amounts of resources, and no one in the free market is going to risk that kind of investment on a whim. I mean, you either, this is going to happen or it's not. You're simply not going to be able to make that kind of investment, and people aren't going to be willing to do that. I mean, it's too big a risk. And this is why governments need to intervene, and governments need to turn around and say, well, you know, you're going to have to put biofuel into petrol so that, you know, we can make the transition. We are going to have biofuel targets, and these are going to be the markets, and this is going to be the likely amount of money that can be made. So that then people, when they're making transition to a renewable resource like second generation biofuels, that you can actually guarantee that it's going to happen, and people have confidence. So the free market simply cannot and is totally unable to make these transitions. And this is one of the reasons why neoliberalism is so, I believe, so opposed to green economics and the whole green agenda, because they realize that in order to make the transition to a green economy, to a sustainable economy, it attacks that fundamental core belief of theirs in that they have the freedom of choice and the absolute freedom of the market, which of course is a total illusion, because we have no free market. Free markets don't exist. We completely control our markets in lots of ways. For instance, you don't have child labour. That's totally illegal, and it should be child. And if you don't have child labour, well, you don't have a free market. And I mean, that's just one example. There's hundreds. I mean, you could go, but because they're so big and because they're so prevailing, we don't see them. It's a classic case of you're not seeing the wood for the trees, and this is a classic case. So there you go. That's my number of the week, 21, and that's 21 opportunities for green growth identified in the new report released today by the Pure Advantage Group.
Sustainable Lens on Radio with Otago Polytechnic.
So, Sam, what have you been thinking about this week?
Well, this week it's exhibition season for Otago Polytech, the Excite Student Showcases. I've just been to the opening of the art, forgotten what it's called, their particular showcase. I think it's actually called Excite. Maybe it's Site, something like that.
I think it's Excite here, yeah.
The whole thing's called Excite. Design's opening was yesterday. Theirs is called Debrief, their collection of all of their different degrees. I'll talk more about the contents of some of that one, because there's I've talked about it before, that there's a really sort of strong, it's more than an undercurrent now, of sustainability running through the final year projects. I've talked about how if we're trying to get this notion of the sustainable practitioners, it's easy for us to, you know, find sustainable practice when you tell them to do it. If you tell somebody to write an essay about, you know, a green economy, they'll do it. Or you know, how does a nurse behave sustainably, that sort of thing. But the final year projects are interesting because they're pretty much given a free hand. You know, go and do something, perhaps for a client in some cases. And I think that's the real clue as to finding out, you know, are we actually making traction on the sustainable practitioner goal? And so on some things, it's about whether or not they're doing the project in a sort of a surface sustainable way. Are they actually using recycled goods, that sort of stuff? And then there is the two sort of the two other layers. One of them is that, if you take away the sustainability word, are they actually doing all the following up the values, the behaviours that we would like them to? And that's all over. And then there's more and more projects that we're seeing coming through across all the disciplines that you could say are explicitly sustainability and not sort of just a surface sustainability. So I'll just tell you briefly about three of the computing ones, because that was our show was on last week, so I know quite a lot about these. I've spent the day finalising their marks for it. So tell you about our projects are assessed by an industry panel of the 12 major projects that went up. Six of them got A pluses.
Wow.
By an independent industry panel, so we're pretty excited about that. And a goodly number of them are have got some heavy sustainability leaning. So one of them is the a group that worked for a farm environmental accreditation process under the water strategy, the National Water Plan. Farms are being required to have environmental management plans. And so the auditing and the management of those plans that we did as a project working with Ian Brown Consulting. That's a really nice piece of work that the students have done, particularly challenging from a database point of view. If you think about the complexities of farm ownership, you know, you might own this farm, but your brother runs it, and during the year you get an environmental farm plan, or you write one, and then you develop a bit of the land, and then you swap some land, and then you have somebody else come in and graze horses on those, and then you swap it back in the family. All of those have different sort of trigger things for the audits. So there's some really interesting work gone on in there. And then from a completely different angle, we've done a project called Panda Island for the Peace Foundation. The Peace Foundation has the initiative called Cool Schools, where they go out and teach in primary and, in fact, all levels of school, I think, a sort of anti-bullying program and peer conflict resolution. And what they do is they get away, you know, four or five of the kids, and do a sort of day's training session on them, and then they have to go back into the school and, you know, change the culture of the school. So some students developed a program, a game called Panda Island, which is aimed at, you know, providing those kids with some resources to engage the rest of the school. So it's a computer game to aid the teaching of problem-solving skills. So it's a purposefully sort of lo-fi in the way that it sort of looks with it. They designed it up in kind of a bit retro-y kind of feel.
Yeah.
Because you can't compete with the billions that Hollywood spends on things. So the alternative approach is to come in sort of low. Do that. So it's a maze where you go around and you collect the bits and pieces to build a boat by solving problems, asking answering questions. And then the project that I can tell you was awarded but 100%.
Wow.
Which doesn't happen very often, but this one is quite impressive. They did a thing called Eco Explore. It's a framework, flexible and scalable framework, built as a foundation for mobile applications to engage members of the public in exploration of natural environments. So it started out as a thing for the Rocky Shore Guide. I don't know if you've been out to Portobello and scrambled around on the rocks out there with a little brochure that's got pictures of all of the animals. Well, the initial goal was to put that onto devices that they could use out there, so they can update them and, you know, make it a bit more interesting for the kids. And they soon discovered that, you know, that wasn't an overly difficult task. And what they really wanted to do was to engage people in the wider realms of science, in the front end of science, the asking questions, and then the back end of science, the analysis and sharing the data and all that sort of stuff. So it's a real citizen, real citizen science thing, including setting up your own questions. And I think that's the most important thing. Is if we go down to the beach and we see a sign that says, you know, don't eat shellfish here. It's there's sewage or something in it, and there's a seal on the beach. Then we need people to be able to question. You know, hey, is that my sewage? Is that affecting the seals? What's the connections here? What's the relationships here? So setting people, you know, people should be able to ask a question. You know, well, what is the seal behavior? You know, do the seals, you know, if anyone sees seals eating these shellfish, perhaps you could record it using this sort of thing here. What's exciting about this particular project, they delivered that for the Portobello, the New Zealand Marine Studies Centre, the Portobello Aquarium. But they've also developed this framework so that they can develop it for, you know, other things reasonably quickly, including things like, you know, taking pictures of sighting, and it's got some really nice reporting and that sort of stuff. So Those are just three of the projects from computing. Next week I'll talk about design, and the week after that I'll talk about some of the ones from art school.
Wow, fantastic.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Welcome back. And tonight our guest is Alec Dawson. Alec is a member of a group called Generation Zero, which is campaigning for a zero carbon economy as part of the pathway to a sustainable future. Last year we had Louis Chambers and Bridget O'Leary in the show from Generation Zero when they just had started up, and we wanted to catch up with Generation Zero and find out what's been happening, as they've been in the press a lot doing things that looked to outsiders like activism, like riding the trains and buses of the capital in your underwear. Welcome to a show. Okay, how's it going? Who came up with that idea about wandering around Wellington on the trains and buses in your underwear?
I can't remember exactly who came up with it, but I think it was a sort of collective sort of process where we came up with the idea, because it was
genius. All over the press.
Oh, it was great. It was great fun. We were very excited about it, but it really emerged because we had a particular campaign we were running this year called 50-50, A Fair Share for Smart Transport, which was aimed at trying to shift the balance in budget spending and transport from like the current ratio, which is something like 95-5 in favour of roads, to a 50-50 split and more in favour of buses and trains and alternative forms of transport, like more cycleways and things like that. And so that was, stunt was aimed to draw attention to that, and there'd been suggestions about getting on trains and doing funny things, and eventually it moved into the underwear territory. And unfortunately, we couldn't do it here in Dunedin as well. There were suggestions of it, but we just don't have the same sort of enthusiasm for commuting into the downtown.
Well, I suppose
they have in Wellington.
You might die on the way in exposure.
Yeah.
So, how did you get involved with Generation Zero, and why did you get involved with sustainability issues, or what got you involved?
I guess in terms of Generation Zero, I was just sort of waiting for the right thing to pop up to jump on board with, because probably since I'd been in high school and started to be exposed to the sort of media, particularly around climate change, films like An Inconvenient Truth, a couple of those sorts of things coming out, generally becoming increasingly more interested and aware of the environmental issues that existed. Meeting Louis, who was going to Copenhagen himself and discussing things like that with him. By the time Generation Zero came around, I was definitely highly interested and aware of environmental issues, and really wanted to be able to do something about that. And so it felt like a good opportunity to get involved.
Cool. And so it basically was just through the media. It wasn't something that you noticed in your environment, or, because I suppose what's a generational thing is, because a lot of older campaigners, what happened is something that they cherished, where they're living, and they noticed that something got polluted, or a river, and I noticed that, with Generation Y, it's often, you've already grown up in this, and it's more the media and the information and knowledge that's coming to you that drives you towards sustainability. Is that
That's a fair comment, because I think a lot of, it was sort of a combination of personal experience. I hadn't seen any pollution myself, but of course, living in the South Island, growing up in the South Island, I spent a lot of time in Central Otago, tramping in the West Coast, and suddenly when you're exposed to that media that shows glaciers disappearing, suggestions of extreme changes in climate and weather patterns that could have huge impacts on the environment and the beautiful landscapes in which we live, that definitely, struck a chord. And so it was sort of the association of the too. But yeah, I'd say it was the media that was a large influence.
Now, you said you were waiting for something, the right thing to come up. What is it about Generation Zero that was right for you?
I guess it was the quite practical and positive focus of it, and also the youth focus. I felt like I was going to be engaged with a bunch of people that were at the same stage of life as me, that were often my friends. A number of them were at that stage, now a lot more of them are, obviously. It felt like it had a very practical focus, specifically on climate change, which I had a particular had particularly strong views about, and so it felt like something that could really get something done, could convince people, and was also a part of a group that I was in.
So what kind of events, apart from the jumping on the buses and the underwear, what other events? I mean, I know you've been doing quite a lot, because I follow you on Facebook and on social media, and on, I've seen you on newspapers and TV. What other things have you been doing during the year? What were the highlights for you?
I guess we've had a couple of really good sort of talks for people. We last year we ran one called Cheer Up Bob, which really kick-started it in Dunedin. We had a similarly named event called Wake Up Pop this year that got a similar sort of surge of interest, where we've got people in talking about it in the university. Just this week, actually, we had quite a cool highlight where a bunch of cyclists biked out of the Octagon, and we had a bit of a breakfast with them, with the mayor and a couple of city councillors seeing them off. And in a couple of weeks' time, this is why they're biking, to get up to Auckland for an event called Power Shift, which I think will probably overshadow them all, because it's going to be big. There's going to be several hundred people in a sort of part festival, part conference happening in Auckland, and that's really going to be big. That'll probably be a big highlight for us.
So Chirrup Bob, who's... Yeah. Well, I know who Bob is, but...
Yeah.
Who is Bob?
This is going back a wee way. Bob is Bob Lloyd. He's a very pessimistic energy studies lecturer at the University of Otago. And we thought we'd get him up and get him to share his views with us, and then get a number of other people to try and cheer him up a bit, because he has a very bleak vision. He obviously, being an energy studies lecturer, thinks a lot about peak oil, peak energy, the idea of the need of decoupling energy and growth, and he's very worried that we're going to run out of oil, that we aren't going to be able to do anything about climate change, and we thought we'd try and say that we actually could do something about that. And that's been the overriding message from Generation Zero, is we can do this, we can do something.
Just in Bob's defence, though, he's not generally pessimistic. He doesn't walk around being miserable.
No, for a guy who seems to think, you know, the apocalypse is coming, he's pretty positive, nice guy, and good to be around.
Did you manage to cheer him up a wee bit?
At the time, he seemed pretty upbeat, but subsequently he's attended Generation Zero events and not been so positive. But he still supports us. He still seems to think that if we succeed, it could happen. I don't think he's given up entirely. And I think his faith really comes from us, which is a nice feeling for us to have.
And you mentioned the other event, Wake Up Pop. What was that about?
That was... it was a similar sort of message. It was about halfway through this year. The idea was sort of, we need to wake up the older generation and get them to do something. And we had a similar sort of set of people come in and give talks about the various things that could be done. We had Jinty McTavish, who'd just been to the Rio Plus 20 festival, talk about what was going on in cities around the world, like Tokyo and around Europe, where changes were being made to try and make them more sustainable and climate friendly. And I guess her vision is that Dunedin could be like that, and the whole of New Zealand, hopefully, as well.
So why? And I'm just trying to tease out a little bit what makes Generation Zero different. Because I mean, you've suddenly come from nowhere to becoming like one of the major groups in the field in a very, very short period of time. Why didn't you volunteer for Greenpeace? I'm curious.
I guess it felt like there was an opportunity to really be involved in the start of something for me personally. But I think if I was to describe to an everyday person what the difference between Generation Zero and a Greenpeace is probably, first of all, the specific climate change focus. That's the issue that we see as the overriding one of importance. But also the approach we take to it, which is about intergenerational justice and fairness towards the future generations and the current young people, and the idea that those young people need to take control of that future and try and cause the change to happen from themselves through their own actions. And that those specific focuses probably make it different, and I feel personally that they probably give us a greater chance of success, because it means that our message is very consistent and very simple and quite New Zealand focused in our case, and also quite pragmatic, in that we want to work with people. We want to work with people from both sides of the political spectrum to the extent that we can, and we also want to have fun. Not to say Greenpeace doesn't want to have fun, they often do, but we don't want to take things too seriously necessarily, hence the underwear stunt.
You're not going to leap in front of harpoons and save whales, or
not yet?
Not at this point. So okay. So one of the things been extremely clever in the way that you use social media, using your stunts, and you've got a very slick website and a very slick online presence. And I know that you've managed to pull together a bunch of very able and intelligent and highly motivated and capable people. And it's reflected, obviously, in the speed with which you've been able to spread across New Zealand and get yourselves organised. One of the things when we talked to Bridget and Louis last year, and when I was looking through your site, there's two words I didn't see. One was activist, our activism, and the other one was politics. And when we talked to Louis and Bridget, they were really, really quite. They did not want to be seen as activists. They weren't, you know, they weren't activists. We're not activists. And yet, everything you've done, all the political, you know, this, and you weren't involved in politics. But the second that you engage, the stuff that you've done is activism, and the second you start engaging in the sphere of changing ideas within the community, you're engaging in politics. It may not be, you know, party politics or traditional politics, but you're engaging in politics. And we've both been really curious, myself and Sam, we've been thinking about this a lot, and Anton was there as well. Do you still feel that you're not activist, or you're not political, or has your mindset changed since then?
I'd still say we don't think of ourselves as activists, and we don't think of ourselves as political. What we want to see is particular things happen, and those can come from anywhere. We don't think they have to come from a particular political party. We think generally they do have to come from the government. We typically want the government to do the actions that we're talking about. So to that degree, we are political, but we're not jumping on board with a particular political party. We're trying to be bipartisan. And I guess we start by thinking about what our goal is, the particular outcome that we want, and we think of the various ways we can get to that, and that sometimes is going to involve things like jumping on trains and underwear. But we're almost, if anything, more enthusiastic about also actively going up to particular politicians and discussing issues with them, and producing ideas and solutions in the same way that the Pure Advantage group that you mentioned before did as well. We don't want to feel like we're locked into a particular avenue and locked into a particular part of the political spectrum, so we try and avoid thinking in that mindset. It's more about being solutions focused and saying how do we get to that solution than anything else.
Didn't Obama try that? Come in saying that it was not about the party politics, it was about change across the aisle and all those sorts of things, and the Republicans pounced on him and wouldn't let him do anything.
He did, and I suppose in some ways you could say that we struggle from the same problem. I'm not even sure that we're on the current government's radar, but they obviously haven't been going in the direction that we'd like them to go in. It came out slightly in our election campaign last year. We ran a election sort of event campaign website called Elect Who, and inevitably the most climate-friendly parties, which are the Green and Labour parties, were the ones that had the most sort of green ticks from us. So we're not afraid to say a particular political party is doing better than another one, and if it comes to it, and it may come to it, if the national government simply rejects outright and continues to reject outright climate-friendy policies, I don't think we're going to reach across the aisle continually.
There are parties, the young North Nationals or whatever they're called on campus, and there's the, I've forgotten what they call themselves, ACT on campus, on our campus. Do you think that it's possible for students to belong to both groups, you know, Generation Zero and, say, ACT on Campus?
ACT on Campus could be difficult for various reasons, because ACT typically denies climate change in some cases. Young Nationals, I think it's totally possible, and at the beginning we did get Young Nats involved. It depends. Perhaps the reason for that to a degree is because the Young Nats have a particular youth bent in an autonomous youth existence, which means that they can take an interest in climate change independently of what the national government is doing. I think you can be, for example, pro-business and a member of Generation Zero in the same way that Pure Advantage try to be. So I don't think you have to have a particularly strong ideological leaning. But I want to be clear, the difference between us and Obama is that we didn't come from the Democrat Party or the Labour Party or the Green Party. So we're not reaching across the aisle. We're trying to reach out to all parties and see who wants to take our hand. And if, even if the predictable...
So you, recognising that you're not... You're purposely not identifying with particular parties, and I think that's, yeah. That's probably a good idea for the role you're trying to take. What I'm trying to figure out in my own mind is, you know, how do you take the people from the right with you? Because I think that in order to make real change, you've got to, you know, we do have to take the whole society with us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the big advantages of being non-partisan is that we don't have to come from a perspective where we are Labour or Greens. We hopefully don't have the treat those people, or those people won't treat us from a perspective as if we have a particular ideological anti-national, anti-Yucknet viewpoint, and that's going to make it easier for us to have common ground. There's going to be less of those presumptions about who we are and what our motivations are, because our motivations aren't political in the sense that we don't want to get elected into Parliament. We just want particular outcomes in terms of policy, and that doesn't depend upon us our party winning or anything like that. So hopefully it's at the very least going to be easier.
Given that people on the, say, the far right are not stupid, why do you think they're denying climate change?
Potentially because climate change is a complex issue and it's easy to get lost in the information that's out there. And I guess that's part of our role, is to try and make sure people are totally and comprehensively and very well informed about the extent of the issue, where the issue comes from, to a degree what the science is.
Yeah, but I would suggest that people on the, you know, people on the left are not necessarily cleverer than people on the right. Mm. So if it was just a ability to wade through information, I would suggest there's no major difference there. So okay. So if we take the approach that the people on the right are taking a rational approach, mm-hmm. for them, we might disagree. Probably yeah. do. But if we assume that they're rational, why do they deny climate change?
Well, again, Generation Zero is not afraid from saying the government does need to take a role here. And if people on the right are ideologically against that from occurring, it might mean that they also tend to reject other aspects to climate change, or at least action on climate change. We are increasingly seeing people on the right accept that climate change is happening, and the disagreement is more and more about what should be done about that, whether or not it's worth trying to cause widespread social and economic change to do so. And at that point, you might see those ideological differences coming through. And ideally, we'd like to try and cross that line and say, no, there's something different about climate change that means that government intervention is necessary, and potentially we can convince them on that without necessarily wholesale convincing them of a different ideology. That's perhaps why the specific climate change focus is useful and good.
You had conversations I was interviewed myself by Generation Zero and videoed and stuff, and we got asked some really, really difficult questions. And what was your experience, or what was Generation Zero's experience of talking to the different politicians? I mean, what kind of degree of being listened to? Was there, were you patronized? Were people, you know, were you taken seriously? What was the feedback you got in general?
It was generally good. I think the experience of interviewing most politicians was a positive one from both sides. People were generally receptive to having a discussion with us and listening to our views about climate change. We got some positive responses from some National Party MPs, such as Simon Bridges and Michael Woodhouse, that I guess some of us didn't expect, but it was really good to see. I wouldn't say we ever got totally patronised. I mean, we interviewed Winston Peters, and he was very typical Winston Peters, a lot of bluster and a lot of very typical Winston Peters statements. But it was a very positive experience, and it's we're going to continue in dialogue with MPs and with candidates going into the local government elections next year, and we do have a plan in place for a project called Adopt an MP, where we actually specifically go and interview interview is the wrong word, have conversations with MPs about climate as an issue, regardless of where they sit on the political spectrum. I mean, we did have some difficult experiences. Like I remember going and discussing with Hillary Calvert, and that was there was a lot of talking past each other going on in that conversation. But broadly speaking, it was positive, and we got well received.
So you're talking to politicians. Who else are you talking to?
We are talking to the media. We're definitely getting as much as we can in terms of, obviously, radio interviews, media interviews, in the press, trying to get as much appearances there as possible. So as many connections there. We're also in constant dialogue with people that are involved in the climate movement, in New Zealand in particular. So Simon Terry, who's a man particularly involved in the climate movement, has been a significant mentor for a number of people within Generation Zero. Local city councillors like Jinty McTavish, who are on our side, Dave Caldermere, is quite supportive of Generation Zero. He threw a nice shout out to us last week with the cycling stunt. So anybody who's receptive, and we have continued plans because we're still an expanding organisation, to go into various communities and community groups and try and outreach as much as possible.
So you're based, you're here in Dunedin, you're obviously in Wellington, you're in Auckland as well, I believe. Where else in the country have you got your groups?
Auckland, Wellington and Dunedin are currently the biggest, probably because there are nice concentrated groups of young people there. Christchurch has been difficult recently, but there's an emerging group in Christchurch. And in other parts of the country, pockets are opening up. I believe in Hamilton and probably in Nelson, and there's a small group in somewhere like Fielding or a small South Island town as well. But those are the main centres, and we hope to continually expand, though.
And with as you're growing and as you're getting more popular, and you're talking to many, you know, you're talking to the community. I mean, do you take this into your career as well? I mean, do you have these conversations in with your families? Are the people coming like saying, "Oh, my mom and dad, they think I'm mad," and I can't get. I mean, are you having those conversations with your family, your friends, all the time? How much does it take over your life? And
I try to avoid it totally taking over my life and the conversations that I have, but it's also a great thing that it does influence the conversations we have. So I talk to my family, who are generally quite receptive. I remember the first time I mentioned it to my dad, he was highly cynical. There's no way you're going to make a difference. And he ended up appearing on one of the videos we made for a stunt earlier this year, which was cool. But also, it definitely influences discussions I have with my friends, although they're a particularly political bunch. I do have a young Nat in my flat, and we have some quite lively discussions about these issues. So, it definitely influences the conversations that I have with people around me. Because it's a passion, because it's... hopefully going to be something that continues to influence what I do with my life. So I guess it influences what we do, but it doesn't take it over entirely, obviously.
So what kind of knowledge do you take then to... for instance, you go to, say, the government and say, look, we want to move to zero carbon, and they say, well, how do we do it? I don't know how to do it. How do you do it? Is that the kind of conversation? I mean, do you have... resources? I mean, where do you pull your science in, or are you simply challenging people to make the move?
I guess it's a little bit of both. We have a solutions team that is coming up with and advocating particular options and solutions that could be taken. For example, the 50-50 transport campaign was a great example of the ability to say, look, roads of national significance aren't even particularly economically viable or beneficial. It would be easy enough to shift that money into another area, considering that there's going to be public spending either way, and that's a small step in the right direction. Similarly, with the recent moves on the ETS, it was simpler enough for us to say, look, there needs to be a limit on carbon in the country. There needs to be these particular solutions that can be taken, because we can easily draw upon large amounts of literature about what can be done, like things like that Pure Advantage report, which we'll probably be seizing upon in the next year to try and start to say, look, here are more solutions. So it's easy for us to, first of all, borrow other people's ideas for solutions, but also to say to the government, look, it is partly your role to actually figure out what needs to be done here and find out solutions. But we try to remain solutions focused and say, and find out where we can, the differences that can be made.
And when you start, talking in the public sphere, do you get challenged a lot? I'm used to being challenged. People say, oh, you drove here in a car, didn't you? It's like, well, yeah, I have to. You don't have a choice. So do you get challenged, and how do you respond to those challenges when people give them to you, whether they're legitimate or not?
I think, fortunately, we don't get too many, you know, aggressive throwbacks like that, like, are you riding a bike every day? What we tend to get more on is sort of the sort of pat on head approach, where it's like, oh, you know, good young kids trying to be good for the community, without really listening to what we're saying and really wanting to jump on board with it. And I think that's probably the main challenge we get when we go out and start to talk to people, is getting taken really seriously about what we're doing. And I guess the way to respond to that is to continue to come across as credible and as serious and as professional as possible, because that's probably the main thing we have to overcome. I guess the easiest example is when we went to the Otago Regional Council and made submissions on the long-term plan earlier this year, and the response was very much a sort of, well, you guys have nice ideas, but we know more than you, basically, and we pushed hard, didn't get much response there, but I guess the only option is to continue to go back and continue to try and come across as knowledgeable and as credible and as professional as possible to them, and hopefully they'll start listening to us.
Yeah, submitting to the regional council is an interesting experience.
Given that they probably won't. Sorry to burst that little bubble there. How long can you keep it up?
Continuing to keep up. Sorry, can you explain that?
The
friendliness?
Yeah, I suppose so. The enthusiasm, the believing that you can make a difference.
I don't know if you... Believing we can make a difference, full stop, we can probably continue believing that forever. I guess one day, if things don't go well, and the International Panel on Climate Change, the big scientific body, comes out and says there's no way we can avoid catastrophic rises in temperature, at that point we're just going to have to change our strategy and say, well, we need to think about adaptation plans now. But I don't know if we're ever going to be able to say these people will never listen to us, because more and more people are being convinced by the issue, and more people are being convinced that things need to be done.
But in the last year, the evidence is coming out even more strongly. There's people like you doing fantastic work in terms of, you know, making media impacts, and meanwhile we're pulling out of Kyoto, agriculture being excluded from the ETS, which means they're going to have an ongoing subsidy, do whatever they like. We're going in the wrong direction, not the right direction, despite doing a really great job in raising the issue. What's going wrong? Or are things that are going right that weren't in my little summary there?
To say that everything's going wrong is probably a bit of an overstatement. It's a matter of, I guess, keeping pushing and keeping trying different things that'll get in their ear. Because in other parts of the world, things are going right. Across Europe in particular, South America's done a bunch of incredible things, like rights for Mother Nature type laws that are being introduced. Places like South Korea injecting large amounts of money, and at the moment we have a government that wants to take a following approach rather than a leading approach. And if we have to convince them that they need to take a leadership approach, I think if more and more people jump on the bandwagon, which is occurring, when you see just today a report comes out saying green growth is possible in New Zealand, and some very defensive responses coming from the national benches, that starts to change things. But
increasingly defensive. Or is that sort of are the defences getting weaker as they get more argumentative in their defences? Is it starting to look sillier?
I didn't see exactly what was going on in the chamber. I just heard that they were defensive.
They were very defensive.
Yeah.
They were yesterday.
Yeah. And they were name calling, which is always a good sign.
Who knows? But it's possible that it is possible that they just don't even know that much about Generation Zero at the moment, because I feel like we're very well known within the green and sustainable community. Like, you guys know who we are, but if you were to talk to people in national, they might have heard the words Generation Zero without necessarily knowing that we can provide them with ideas.
They know who you are.
And that's excellent.
They know it. They don't like you.
If you were to, borrowing the miracle question from motivational interviewing, scale of 1 to 10, you know, 1 being it's totally terrible, 10 being it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we at the moment? Don't care what your number is, but where it is. You wake up in the morning and it's 1 better. Right?
Mm-hmm.
What's changed? What's the thing that you'd like to see or could see that would be, yep, that's a thing that's better, that's a first tangible step?
reversing the changes to the emissions trading scheme that were just made would probably be a step up. I guess Generation Zero is not specifically focused on this, but if the international negotiations started to look better, that would be an improvement. Of course, Generation Zero is more locally focused and New Zealand focused, so a cap on emissions would really be a big boost, probably 2 points for that. But if, for example, that Pure Advantage report, if National was to say, or the government, sorry, was to say, well, we're gonna take a couple of those and we're going to invest in those, again, that will be another sort of one step up. Various types of actions.
What have you learned, you know, as a person, possibly the organisation has learned through your, you know, through your work since you started? What lessons have you learned about activism or advocacy?
I suppose that from the start we've kind of learned increasingly that the message is key, and continuing to sound totally positive and injecting humour into what we're doing and having a fun time is really important at every level of what we're doing, from the stunts that attract attention to the lowest levels when we're working in small groups and devising what we're going to do next, just being enthusiastic with one another, and just being as effective at communicating with one another within the organisation as possible, I think has been a massive thing. Making sure everybody's on the same page, making sure everybody's happy with what they're doing. And I think Generation Zero is increasingly doing a better job at that. So it's a welcoming environment and a friendly and happy environment. And that's been something that I've personally learned is absolutely crucial. It's just the relationships within the organisation that matter so much, which is probably not an answer specifically about advocacy itself, but about just how to be an effective organisation.
So how do you come to make decisions? I mean, what kind of model do you have a model that you use to think of campaigns and what position are we going to take on this?
It's very participatory. Like everybody has an opportunity to voice it. Although we do have a central organising team called the National Support Group, but the way we like to think about that is that they're at the bottom of a pyramid and support everybody else and what they do. So we have umbrella campaigns for the whole country, but local regional groups are very much empowered to take charge and say this is the particular thing we're going to do to promote that campaign ourselves, and then generally if we come up with a cool new idea, we're free to go and do that. So there's a lot of freedom in terms of what we can do, and there's a lot of participation in the decisions that are made.
So it's very much it's a very flat structure that you have.
That's the aim, and the National Support Group still does the bulk of the work, so we do rely on them to a degree, but there is a flat and open environment where anybody can talk to them at any stage, and they'll listen and often take those ideas. Ideas can come from people that have just joined the organisation, which is incredible.
And how do you fund yourselves? I mean, obviously, there's always going to be little costs, like, you know, do a bit of printing, host a website, all that stuff. How do you fund yourselves? I mean, do you have fundraising activities, or you just, like, chip in, or...?
There's no membership fee. It generally comes from grants and fundraising activities. Sort of when we have a specific thing that we're running, like if we're doing a training hui or running a particular event, generally we can probably find grants and sponsorship from various avenues. And sometimes if there's an event happening, all the people involved sort of say, all right, we'll put in a little bit just to get ourselves over the line. Probably typical sort of grassroots. Community work type stuff, just getting local groups to help us out.
Can I just take a couple of steps back? You said there's something different about climate change. What is different about climate change?
The scale of the threat, for a start. It's something that is international and plays such a role that it is going to influence our identities and how we live and how we think about ourselves for a long time to come, whether or not it's climate change is happening and we have to adapt and deal with that, or it's transitioning to that low carbon economy. One way or another, it's going to be an incredibly integral part of human existence. The other thing to it is the way that the way people are behaving now impacts upon people in the future in such a distinctly direct way. The very action of emitting carbon emissions now is actually having that sort of almost direct influence on people's livelihoods in the future, which changes both the economics of it, because it's a group that actually has no participation in the market, if you like, and no participation in current political systems that are going to be affected by something that everybody that currently participates in those things is doing right now. So I guess the scale of it and the nature of it, the way it impacts upon the future specifically rather than anybody else. Well, that's actually less true if you look at what happened with Hurricane Sandy, but that is the particular differences with it, in my view.
It's always going to be tricky when we don't actually have models for intergenerational equity.
Exactly.
We can talk about them and make it sound nice, but it doesn't actually exist.
And that's why intergenerational justice is such a tagline from Generation Zero. We're trying to advocate for future generations in what we're doing, specifically.
How do you respond to people that say it's going to be fantastic, we're going to be growing grapes on the Tyree?
I guess it's just a matter of saying, well, on the flip side, we're going to have thousands of climate refugees knocking on the door of our country wanting to move in, and just saying, look, that's all very well, but the damage that occurs in other parts of the world is something that should matter to us, even if it doesn't hurt us. Those people matter. And if it's going to hurt them, then that's a problem. But also, to say that New Zealand's going to be better off all of a sudden is probably a lie. There's also evidence coming out that farming in the Hawke's Bay is going to be impossible within the next few decades. It'll probably significantly impact the agriculture industry in New Zealand as we get a significantly wetter west coast and a significantly drier east coast. And when South Dunedin's already below sea level, the idea that the water table there is going to rise with rising sea levels and cause houses to sink is probably also a significant harm that's pretty tangible. So I think we basically can just list numbers of things that will happen on the negative as well as the positive side.
Do you also focus on describing the zero carbon economy as a better, not lesser place? Have I heard you use that phrase or something?
Absolutely.
Like that?
If anything, the idea of a zero carbon economy is an opportunity, because we already live within a world where there's nothing that nice about smog and carbon, and petrol's quite dirty. There's something clean about a zero carbon economy involving that doesn't use those sorts of things. It doesn't involve burning things. That doesn't involve the smells and dirt of that. That in itself would be a better world. But also, I think the feeling and the security that we would get out of a world that was more sustainable, that we could maintain more easily because it didn't involve burning resources that were gone as soon as we burned them, that tapped into a resources that were more permanent. All of that would be a better world to live in, and that means that this idea of a zero carbon economy is a great opportunity. But more than that, it's an economic opportunity. It allows us to move into exciting new areas of technological development and change in ways that are positive and exciting, in the same way that so many changes in human history have actually been exciting for people. It's change and it's cool change, and that's something cool.
Do you actually mean zero carbon economy or less? Have you defined that?
What we would like to see from Generation Zero is a zero net carbon emissions by 2050, or within our generation, if you like, hence the name Generation Zero. Obviously, we don't want that to occur overnight, but low carbon within the next few decades would be the chief aim. Whatever is, as far as we can tell through the science, going to be safe in the long term.
We didn't ask at the start. What are you studying?
I'm a law student and a BA as well, and I've just finished my fourth year.
Congratulations. Is there a particular role for legal people? Not in Generation Zero, but in this.
There'll always be a role for lawyers, no matter what we're doing.
What's the role of lawyers in this transition to a low carbon economy?
Well, I guess there's a strict legal role in terms of the drafting of legislation, potentially in legal advocacy in some parts of the world. In the United States, there are significant legal organisations that try and take on and challenge particular things in the legal realm. But I guess beyond that, the things that you gain when you gain legal skills are helpful in terms of a critical thinking way, in terms of thinking about particular policy. That means that lawyers are involved, at least that's what I hope anyway. I hope that my skills will be useful, or maybe I should be studying something else.
Okay, we're probably wrap up in a second. I wanted to ask you one more thing. I mean, you do realise that this is going to be a profound philosophical shift in the way our entire society thinks about how it exists in the world. Do you have a consciousness about that, or are you just like kind of? Is that something that's?
Do you mean the way that we think about how our economy should run in terms of it being sustainable, or how we behave?
Our relationship with each other and with our planet and with our future generations. I mean, my great grandchildren, I'll never meet them, but I have a responsibility to them. We need to make that shift. Yes.
No, I think we need to make that shift. I don't know if it's that hard a thing to grapple with, the idea that there are people that are going to exist in the future. And I think, actually, if you think about the history of humanity, it's always been pushing towards creating a better future. And given that, I don't think it's a huge philosophical shift to suddenly have a world where we're thinking about a better future. It's only a very recent phenomenon that we perhaps exist in a world where people are thinking about what they want for themselves. Because if you think about the early 20th century in particular, where people were struggling through wars and depression, the aim was a better future, and that's what we want as well. So we don't think it's too big a change.
Brilliant, fantastic. You're listening to the Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM. This has been the show for the 15th of November, 2012, and the guest was Alec Dawson from Generation Zero. Our panelist was Professor Samuel Mann, and your host was me, Shane Gallagher. Our music is sourced from the Free Music Archive, and you can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe in iTunes or on oar.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.